This is an interview with Dennis Dirks for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. Today is August 26th, 2011. I'm James Stoker. We're talking at Mr. Dirks' home on Long Island in New York. Welcome, Mr. Dirks.
Thank you.
So we're here on Long Island, but I understand that you were born in Queens.
Yes, that's correct.
Were either of your parents involved in finance or business?
No. My father was a New York City fireman, and my mother was a housemaker.
Okay. You've worked at the center of finance and technology. Were you interested in technology at all as a child?
Yes. When I was in high school, that's when computers were first becoming fairly prominent. So I took some courses in Fortran on my own because I was always interested in programming. And then when I went to college, I was an English major in college. I was going to write the great American novel, which never actually happened. But even in college, because of my interest in computers, I did take some programming courses as electives. So I've always been interested in computer technology.
And you attended Manhattan College, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So how did an English major end up working for the New York Stock Exchange?
Well, essentially, my uncle was a specialist on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. He was also on the exchange's board of governors. And during the summers, when I was in high school and to some extent in college, I worked on the floor of the exchange in a summer intern type of work. And as I got closer to graduation, I realized that although English was always a great love of mine, it was very difficult to earn a good living as an English teacher, which is what I had intended on becoming. And my uncle had always reminded me that if I ever changed my mind and was interested in a career on Wall Street, I should let him know. And I did, and because of his contacts with the exchange, he got me an interview and I was accepted in a management trainee program in the exchange's compliance area. And I spent my first years working after college in the New York Stock Exchange's compliance department, which was very, very interesting and gave me a very good appreciation of the difficulties that compliance people, such as the Fed or the SEC, have. So it was a very good background. But
just to go back a little bit, you said you did an internship there in high school. What was that like?
Well, I was a page boy. I don't know if you know what that is. But I was,
tell me what that was. What did you
basically, in those days, the New York Stock Exchange was not electronic at all. And orders that came in from customers would be phoned to the floor of the exchange. And floor clerks, as they were called, would write the orders down on a piece of paper. And then there was this giant annunciator board on both sides of the exchange floor, with the numbers of the various brokers on the annunciator board. So if the broker was needed to execute an order, the phone clerk would press a button, that broker's number would show up on this annunciator board, the broker would know that there were orders for him to execute, and he would yell, page, page, or squad, squad, and somebody like myself would run over to the broker and he would say, you know, pick me up at the Joseph Hall. And one of the things about being a page boy is you learned, you took tests to learn where all of the brokerage firms were located on the external walls of the exchange. And the page boy would go run to that phone clerk, get the order, and then run back and give it to the broker, who would then go to the specialist for that particular security and execute the trade.
Would the page just work for one broker or a couple of brokers?
Oh, no, the page worked for the New York Stock Exchange, so okay. You actually worked for any broker on the floor. And that was basically how they'd signal that they needed you. They'd yell, as I said, squad or page, and then you'd run over and do whatever that particular broker needed done.
Did a lot of former pages end up working either for the New York Stock Exchange or on Wall Street?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know if my experience was typical or atypical, but it was very exciting to be there. I happened to be on the floor the day that Abbie Hoffman and his buddies showed up, ripped up dollar bills, and started flinging them onto the floor of the exchange. And what I found the most interesting part of that whole thing was that the people diving for the money with the greatest amount of alacrity were the brokers and the specialists, whereas the pages were looking around at these folks. So I guess it was a very good introduction into how Wall Street actually functions.
Wow.
So, and ever since that time, by the way, the exchange put up plexiglass wall to ceiling so that no one could again throw something on the floor of the exchange.
So that was directly because of what Abby
Hoffman
did?
Because of that incident, yes.
Okay. So you said you started working in the area of compliance. Tell me a little bit about what you did in that area.
Well, the exchange at that time had a division called the Member Firms Division. And Member Firms was responsible for making certain that the individual brokerage firms were adhering to exchange rules, particularly Rule 325, which was the net capital rule. The exchange spent a lot of money and a lot of effort to make certain that its brokerage firms were solvent and met the minimum requirements that the exchange stipulated for capital. In fact, when it was there, the first New York Stock Exchange firm went public, Donaldson Lufkin, and that was the beginning of the end of the partnership system, which had been completely the prevalent mode of operation prior to that. And also during that period, which was in the early 70s, I witnessed a lot of very good firms going out of business, Goodbody and Company, W.E. Hutton.
This was because of the back office crisis?
If you remember, Perot bought DuPont, which at one point was a very, very significant exchange member firm. And Perot thought because of his computer experience and knowledge he'd be able to turn DuPont around. That really didn't work. I think he lost a fair amount of money on that particular investment, and DuPont ultimately went out of business. Mm-hmm. So it was a very trying time because of the problems that people had with back office processing. Mm-hmm. Goodbody was a very famous firm that failed because it was unable to keep track of all the trading that was going on internally. And Merrill Lynch rescued Goodbody and took over its accounts.
While you were working there, did you have any contact with the Central Certificate Service?
Only in a sense that I knew that the exchange was forming something like that. It wasn't called Central Certificate Service initially. It was called CCAC, and frankly, I don't recall what those initials stood for. It was some kind of central accounting service, and that was the forefather of became CCS.
Mm-hmm. What about the Bankings and Securities Industry Committee that was also working on some of those issues?
Honestly, I had no knowledge of their work until I became an employee at CCS, which was later on in my career.
Right. Uh-huh. So you stayed at the New York Stock Exchange for about 2 years.
Right.
And then you went on to somewhere else. What did you do?
Well, again, with the intervention of my uncle, I'll never forget this conversation. My uncle told me one day, you know, I don't think you're going, you shouldn't really stay at the exchange. And I said, why? He said, well, you know, even the chairman of the exchange only makes $200,000 a year. You really want to limit yourself to, you know, that as the ultimate salary. So I thought $200,000 at that particular time was quite a princely sum of money. But
of course, it's only gone up since then.
Yes, yes. But he had a friend named Morris Goldstein, Goldie, as he was called. And Goldie owned a specialist firm, a very small one called M.E. Goldstein and Company. And my uncle felt that I'd be well suited to go work for Goldie for a number of reasons. First of all, it was a small enough firm that did its own clearing work, that even if I decided to stay in the operations end of the business, I would get a tremendous education as to how to actually clear and settle transactions. And secondly, Goldie did have a small arbitrage and trading operation, and my uncle thought that if I had a predisposition to do that, and Goldie was interested in putting me in that area, then I'd have an option of going either direction, working in operations as a career or possibly becoming a trader.
Mm-hmm. So you said that they did their own clearance and settlement. How did that work?
Well, essentially back in those days, the precursor to NSCC was a stock exchange firm called Stock Clearing Corporation. And it was a very straightforward concept. At the end of the day, you sent down to Stock Clearing Corporation all the records of any transactions you completed that day. Similarly, the other firms that you did business with sent their records of those trades to Stock Clearing Corporation, and Stock Clearing Corporation matched them. And the next day, you'd get what were called contract sheets. Those trades that matched perfectly were basically, at that point, locked in on these contract sheets. And then they would give you DK, or don't know reports, they're called, which would indicate where there might have been a difference. You said the trade was 33 and an eighth. Your counterparty said it was 33 and a quarter. It would turn out as a difference that both firms had the work to resolve. And then once it was resolved, one party, usually the seller, would put the trade back into Stock Clearing Corporation, saying that we've reached agreement with the buyer, and now the trade is in fact good, and here's the price at which the trade, we all agree, was done. And essentially back in those days, trades settled T plus five. So basically 5 days after the trade, you would complete the transaction. And there was two ways of doing it. CCS had just started at that point. So you could submit a form which was called an MDO, a miscellaneous deliver order, in which the seller would instruct CCS to deduct shares from its account versus a certain amount of money and put those shares in the account of the buyer, charging the buyer that amount of money. Or you could use what was called the Stock Clearing Corporation's envelope system. Basically there, if you had physical stock certificates and you were the seller, you would basically render the certificates negotiable so that they could be transferred. You would put them in an envelope, just a regular envelope. You'd put the name, or the number rather, of the broker that you had sold that stock to, deliver it to Stock Clearing Corporation. They would sort the envelopes, put them in the receiving broker's bins, and runners would come down near the end of the day, collect all of those envelopes with the stock in them. And the Stock Clearing Corporation would keep track of the monies involved, and then you'd have a settlement at the end of the day, mm-hmm. either settlement through CCS for the securities that went through that organization, but predominantly through Stock Clearing Corporation, because mm-hmm. initially CCS was just starting, so the most of the deliveries were still physical going through Stock Clearing Corporation.
Okay. Now, you said that back then the settlement and clearance process took about 5 days from the trade date. Did that always work out in practice, or were there sometimes
fails? Oh, no. You would frequently have fails.
Yeah.
Where, and in fact, there'd be a charge, a capital charge, that the exchange would levy against each firm based on how many fails to deliver that firm had and how many fails to receive that the firm had. And during the financial crisis of back in the early 70s, the back office crisis, it was pretty horrific in terms of the total number of fails that were outstanding mm-hmm. because the process just choked. The volume on the exchange grew, I mean, by today's standards, laughably small amounts, but back then, because everything was done so in a highly manual basis, trades just got choked in the process, and a lot of fails occurred, and Frank, as we discussed earlier, that was the cause of the failures of many of those firms we talked about, Goodbody, DuPont, W.E. Hutton, firms like that.
Now, did you expect to stay with the specialist for quite a few years? Or?
Well, basically what happened, I always, as I mentioned earlier, had an interest in technology. I was going to Bernard Baruch College, City College, mm-hmm. and was getting an MBA in computer technology. Because I was an English major, it took longer than normal because I had to take some basic business courses first before I actually took the computer courses.
You were taking classes at night?
At night. And it became pretty clear to me that Goldie didn't really have an interest, at least in the short term, for me to join the trading area. Because, as I said, it was a very small trading department, only had three traders in it. All three of those fellows were young people, weren't going anywhere. And I soon came to the conclusion that what was the point of getting a master's degree in computer science working for a firm that had no computers whatsoever? Everything was done by adding machine tapes and manual ledgers and things of that nature. So I went in to see Goldie, and I basically explained my situation. He was very gracious, understood completely, told me to don't worry, you've got a job here until you find something that is more appropriate. And then, frankly, a friend that I had worked with in my initial job at the New York Stock Exchange in the compliance area, he had gotten a job at CCS. I happened to be speaking to him one day and explaining to him my situation. He said, oh, you should come over here. First of all, we got plenty of computers. Second of all, since it's a brand new organization just getting off the ground, it would give you a real opportunity to, you know, basically get in on the ground floor.
At that time, had Bill Dentzer already come into CCS?
No, at the time, CCS was run sort of as a division of Stock Clearing Corporation. And there was a gentleman who headed Stock Clearing Corporation. His name was Dieron Kaluzny.
Did you know him personally, or was he a very big organization?
No, I know. Okay. Essentially, though, it was very clear that CCS would never succeed unless the banks fully embraced using it. And the fear was, and this is part of the basic work, the fear was that if the banks viewed CCS as strictly a broker-dealer run and governed organization, they'd be very reluctant, for understandable reasons, to put their assets into such an organization.
What were the reasons?
Well, essentially, you know, they're custodians for all these mutual funds and insurance companies. They have responsibilities to make sure that those shares are safeguarded and no losses occur. And CCS, when it first began, was a rather unproven organization that did have some, you know, embarrassing computer foul-ups when it first initially began. So BASIC came up with the idea, essentially, that for this to work, it would have to be owned jointly by the broker-dealers and the banks. And Bill Dentzer was the former superintendent of banks in New York State. Now, obviously, I was too junior to know how he was approached, who approached him, but ultimately he agreed to become the chairman of CCS, which very briefly was called CCS Inc., I think for about a year, and then it became DTC. I honestly forget the year. It was sometime in the 70s.
That must have been 74, I think.
I think it was 74.
Yeah.
Over time, as you'd expect, Bill Dentzer started to exert a tremendous amount of influence on how the company was run, what kind of strategies we would pursue, always keeping foremost in his mind, as he should have, that for us to succeed, he really had to persuade the banks that this was a safe organization in which they would have a, you know, significant voice as far as its governance and operation were concerned.
Right.
And you did a very, very good job at that, no question about it.
Yep. So what sort of issues were you working on during these early years?
When I got to DTC?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Basically, my initial assignments were almost all computer-related because that's what I was interested in and I was getting my master's degree in.
What kind of computers did you have?
Well, we had IBM 360s was the main frames that we used, but my initial assignments were to work on a data entry systems. The company, which is no longer in business, is called Four-Phase. But I became a Four-Phase expert, taught myself how to program those machines. And essentially, we went from key punching on punch cards into data entering everything on this particular equipment. Mm-hmm. And then I self-taught myself COBOL, and I then started programming for the mainframes that we operated. And during that time, the Midwest, just stepping back, the Midwest Stock Exchange Clearing Corporation had developed a continuous net settlement system, mm-hmm. which was regarded by everyone as being a very, very superior system compared with the system that Stock Clearing Corporation had.
Tell me briefly, what was continuous net settlement?
Well, the basic idea is, going back to what I said earlier about trade settling on trade day plus mm-hmm. five, you could be in a situation where you owed Merrill Lynch, let's say, 100 shares of IBM. Because of trading that took place the next day, Merrill Lynch now owed you 100 shares of IBM. Under the old Stock Clearing Corporation system, those two trades were completely independent of each other. So I physically, or through CCS, had to deliver 100 shares of IBM to Merrill Lynch. And then lo and behold, the very next day, Merrill Lynch would turn around and deliver 100 shares of IBM to me. What's the beauty of the CNS system is that if I failed to deliver that 100 shares to Merrill Lynch on settlement day, the next day the delivery would be wiped out because the continuous net settlement system recognized that you had two offsetting transactions. So instead of both organizations having to do a fair amount of work, even though there was a fail for a day in this example, no work was needed. You just recorded on your records that you had bought and sold 100 shares of IBM. Merrill Lynch recorded on its records that it had bought and sold 100 shares of IBM. But no IBM actually had to be delivered to anybody.
So you basically had a system that kept track of all the trades and then
netted them out.
Okay.
So one of my first major assignments at DTC was that there was a decision made that for competitive reasons, since the Midwest Clearing Corporation's continuous net settlement system was so far superior to what Stock Clearing Corporation had, Stock Clearing Corporation started rushing into developing a continuous net settlement system of its own. And by this time, DTC had become very stable, very accepted. And so it was clear that these transactions would settle through DTC. So I worked with the Clearing Corporation people to develop CNS. They did the programming for the actual matching of the trades and the actual netting of the trades. Mm-hmm. I did the work with my team of the actual settlement of the transactions that went through DTC.
And when you say Clearing Corporation, you mean NSCC?
It became NSCC. Again, as I mentioned to you earlier, dates aren't my strong suit at this point, but sometime during the 70s, Stock Clearing Corporation became National Clearing Corporation, and then National Securities Clearing Corporation.
There are also regional clearing corporations in different parts of the country,
right,
too,
there
right?
was one in the Pacific Coast. There was one, as I mentioned, in Chicago. There was one in Philadelphia, there was one in Boston, and each tried to attract clearance and settlement of transactions done on the floors of their respective exchanges to their respective clearing corporations and depositories. Mm-hmm. And so there was a fairly lengthy period of time where there was somewhat healthy competition between all of these organizations, but essentially what happened over time is that the economies of scale that both NSCC and DTC brought to this kind of processing, it became so apparent that those organizations could process those transactions mm-hmm. much less expensively than the other organizations, through no fault of their own. They were, generally speaking, very well run, very capable management teams. They just simply didn't have the kinds of volumes of transactions that NSCC and DTC had. So gradually, over time, all of them basically sold their businesses, in effect, mm-hmm. to either NSCC on the clearance side or DTC on the depository side.
You mentioned the fact that during the 1970s, the name of the clearing corporation was changing and the structure was changing. So from Stock Clearing Corporation to National Clearing Corporation to the NSCC finally.
Right.
Now this was a process that was the object of some public attention, and the SEC and the Justice Department got involved, and there was a lot of debate about whether a quasi-monopoly should be granted to this this corporation. Was DTC involved in that at all, or were they just standing back and saying we'll work with whoever is there?
Well, it was always some concern that if you put all your eggs in one basket, as Warren Buffett liked to say, you better watch the basket. And so both organizations, I think, did a very good job of being very conscious of the fact that as they got more and more important in the business and started to process the predominant volumes in the business, a great deal of attention and care was given to making sure that the systems were well run, that they were backed up. We did very, very frequent backup tests all through the years that I was there, just to because of that issue. You know, there was no question that you had to make sure that if you were banking on these organizations to be there, that they had better well be there, regardless of whether it's a natural disaster or any other kind of disaster that might take place.
Right.
And the regulators, I think, in fairness, were pretty strong-willed about that, particularly the Federal Reserve Bank, because in the 80s, when DTC started to process commercial paper and municipal bonds and other Fed-like, well, municipal bonds were not Fed-like securities, but commercial paper was, the Fed was very vigorous about making certain that we had adequate backup, that we would have the necessary resources to be there, duplicate data centers, you know, things of that nature.
During this early period, though, in the 1970s, did you on the technical end have to work much with the SEC? I mean, were they interested in the specifics of the systems design, or were they more interested in the big picture?
Yeah, I never really had any involvement with the SEC as far as any systems-related work, quite frankly.
Right. So they were quite content to let DTC handle that and then just look at the bigger picture.
Well, I honestly don't recall, but I don't believe the SEC had a significant computer expertise at that particular point in time, so I'm not even sure that they had the wherewithal to even opine on the system that we were putting in place. And I don't mean that as a criticism. I just think that those are the facts as I recall them, anyway.
Yep. Did you also have to design technical systems that would enable you to interface with the regional depositories around the country?
We spent a great deal of time developing interfaces, they were called, with each of the regional depositories, because they made the point, which was a valid point, I think, that if you had a broker like AG Edwards, which was considered to be a, quote, Midwest-type brokerage firm, since they were based in St. Louis, if the argument that the Midwest Stock Exchange used, and I think persuasively, was that if AG Edwards wants to settle its transactions in Chicago with us, there should be an interface between the New York clearance and settlement organizations and those based in Chicago so that AG Edwards would have that choice. And so they could technically settle their transactions in Chicago even though they might have done the transaction with a broker based in New York. So that was a fairly, frankly, big bone of contention during those years, because everybody wanted to make sure that they weren't disadvantaged by building an interface that might, even though it might have been inadvertent, favored one party over another as far as this competitive issue of interfaces was concerned. So I'd say we spent a tremendous amount of time, effort, and money building those interfaces and maintaining them with a fair amount of political noise in the background, because everyone, as I said, wanted to be certain that they were not disadvantaged in the process.
So was, for instance, Congress talking about the technical details of these interfaces, or what?
No, it was this is one area that the SEC spent a lot of time on and did, in fact, make a real effort to assure the smaller players in particular that they had a equal part in the game. I think essentially, though, what basically hurt those organizations significantly was stock lending. Stock lending was a big business back in the 80s and 90s, and most of the stock lending was being done in New York. Now, some people might disagree with that and argue that it's not true, but from my experience, it in fact was true. So what happened is that you take a firm like A.G. Edwards, if they wanted to be very active in the stock lending business, they had to really have assets at DTC because the stock lending was taking place in New York, and it didn't really help them to have this interface that would enable them to deliver securities from Chicago to New York, because that added an extra layer of complexity to the transaction. So my own personal opinion, which is strictly that, my personal opinion, is that the stock lending business essentially doomed the smaller clearing corporations and depositories in other cities, because even though the interfaces on paper gave everybody an equal play in the clearance and settlement business, if you had a big stock lending firm in New York and they wanted those securities immediately, they didn't want to hear anything about, oh, there'd be a day delay because we have to move them through this interface transaction, that, you know, interface system that was built. So I think gradually, as I said earlier, economies of scale started to eat away at the profitability of these various other clearing corporations and depositories. And one by one, they essentially decided that they could no longer compete.
How did the interfaces work? Did you have modems at that time?
Most of the time, it was initially very, very almost Neanderthal by today's standards, transmissions of tapes. We would transmit tapes to Chicago. Chicago would transmit tapes.
So you had an interface, but you had to actually either use the mail or send a truck or something?
No. It was done over phone lines.
Oh, over phone lines.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it was automated.
Okay, it was on.
But it was a fairly, by today's standards, pretty rudimentary, you know, type of system.
Okay. So in 1980, you became a VP for operations at DTC. How did your duties there change?
Well, essentially, we skipped a slight step in my career when I was finished with the CNS systems work. I really wanted to do something different. And a gentleman named William Janicki joined DTC, and his initial job at DTC was to be in charge of marketing, basically trying to get banks and other large institutions to use DTC, because it obviously was a much more effective system if everybody was playing in the same ballpark. For example, there were plenty of times before the banks became full members of DTC that a broker would receive delivery of securities, let's say 100,000 shares of IBM, through DTC, pay for them through DTC, and then find to its dismay that the customer who was being custodied at a bank didn't use DTC. So the broker would have to come to DTC and physically withdraw the certificates, which we call the COD, Certificates on Demand, and then physically deliver them to the bank. And there was always obviously going to be some delays in that process, and the brokers were losing a fair amount of interest float because they had already paid for these securities but couldn't get paid themselves for them until they physically delivered them to the custodian bank, let's say, for example, State Street Bank. So Bill's initial job, he was hired by Bill Dancer, Bill Janicki's initial job was to market DTC services to not only the New York Clearinghouse banks, but the large regional banks, because we recognized very quickly unless we succeeded in getting the banks heavily into DTC, the brokers would always have this tremendous handicap of the added expense of having to deliver securities to the banks. And so I, frankly, at that point, had gotten a little worn out doing systems assignments. I wanted the change. Bill came in as a new player in the game with this mandate to try to market DTC to institutions and banks. So I joined Bill in a segment of DTC called Participant Services, which, and I was given the mutual funds. So my assignment before I went into operations in 1980 was to go around, visit the various mutual funds, not to get them to join DTC directly, because none of them would do that for a whole bunch of reasons, but to encourage them to get their custodian banks to agree to use DTC. And that was a large, very successful. It took time and a lot of patience, but it was key to DTC ultimately becoming as successful as it did, was to get the banks into the system.
Was your focus on the New York banks and mutual funds, or were you looking all over the country? Were you traveling all over the place?
Well, candidly, we felt that there was some New York banks were somewhat resistant to doing this, because they ultimately felt that a good part of their business would go away if DTC was successful. For example, the transfer agent business, to name one. So there was a strategy of trying to encourage regional banks to join directly to help persuade the New York banks that the world was changing, and that if they didn't change with it, some of these regional banks could take business away from them, because they would be able to do transactions through DTC directly. So it was a strategy that wasn't terribly well appreciated by some of the New York banks, but it did in fact result in what we hoped that it would.
Did it also bother the regional depositories as well, that you were going after banks in their area? Or?
It did, but honestly, when you consider the difficulty of persuading a bank that historically has kept its securities in its own vaults to now trust an organization that would be holding all of the securities for them, in my humble judgment, the regional depositories had a very, very difficult sell in that regard. At least in DTC, you had an organization that was growing quite rapidly, had gradually gotten a reputation for probity and for excellent systems and things of that nature. And I think that's one of the advantages that DTC had over the regional players. I think banks that were seriously contemplating joining a depository for the first time were not going to join one that was less than what was considered to be at the time best of breed. And I'm not trying to say that with any degree of pride or anything like that. It's just that was a fact.
Did you have a standard sales pitch that included talks about your vaults and your security?
Oh, yeah. I remember so many times, you know, questions like, what if an atom bomb goes off in New York? What will happen to all our securities?
Well, what do you say to that?
Well, my usual answer was, well, I'd be concerned depending on where I physically was at the time. it's a question that... how do you answer something like that? You know, that
it was during the Cold War, though. People were thinking about those things.
People definitely were, but we pointed out that we kept backup records of everything that we did at off-site locations. The depository's holdings could be reconstructed if there was such a monumental disaster. And I think, frankly, each of the banks had that concern for themselves. What do they do if an atomic mishap occurred affecting them? So it was an issue, and it was an issue that people liked to talk about, but as a practical matter, I think most people realize that you gotta face day by day real business situations, and to start basing your planning on Armageddon is I think, somewhat counterproductive. You know.
At this time, was there any talk about switching over to book entry only securities or getting rid of stock certificates or anything like that?
DTC started down that path with a program they called it's the FAST program. And under FAST, what we tried to do was persuade cooperating transfer agents that, well, let me step back. When certificates were deposited in DTC, the normal process is we would render them negotiable, send them to the transfer agent for those securities. The transfer agent would then re-register the securities out of the name of the party that they were in and put them into CEDE&Co, CEDE, which was DTC's nominee. Then they'd return the certificates to us and we'd put them in the vault. And gradually, as we grew more successful, we would have certificates in the vault, you know, 3 million shares of IBM in a single certificate, you know, that kind of thing. So it became pretty clear to us early on that if we could work with the transfer agents and develop a FAST concept, basically the transfer agent would not return the certificate to DTC. The transfer agent would keep a record on its records of DTC's holdings in IBM, let's say, and then just add to that holding as deposits came in, or reduce the holding as the certificates were withdrawn from the system. And FAST became quite successful. It stood for Fast Automated Securities Transfer. And as more and more transfer agents joined FAST, there were fewer and fewer certificates in DTC's vaults, and gradually over time they developed the concept of book entry only securities, which, if memory serves me correctly, it was largely municipal securities that started that process. When Congress outlawed bearer bonds and all municipal securities had to become registered, most of the time, these certificates don't trade all that much once they're initially sold. Mm-hmm. They really are sold to investors who want tax-free income during the life of the security. And some very imaginative broker-dealers and municipalities came up with the concept that, gee, well, let's not even issue certificates. Let's say that the whole issue is owned by CD and company. Mm-hmm. DTC, in turn, would keep a record on its computer files of the individual brokers who owned that security, and then the brokers would keep records of the actual beneficial shareholder, the person who actually owned the municipal bond. So in the late 80s...
Yeah, that's an interesting story. Yeah, I definitely want to ask you about that. Just to start at the beginning of the 1980s, so you became VP for operations.
Right.
And... let's see, what were the major priorities for the DTC at that point?
Well, the major priorities were basically to cut our costs as much as possible, and our biggest cost was clearly processing certificates. So back in the early 80s, we would have anywhere between 20 and 30,000 deposits a day, and anywhere between 20 and 30,000 withdrawals by transfer.
And these are the physical certificates.
Physical certificates.
So you had an armored truck coming in and bringing in the certificates?
Well, we would take all the deposits and trundle them off to the transfer agents to get them transferred into CEDE&Co name. Then we would pick them up and bring them back to DTC, now registered in CEDE&Co. We put them in our vault. In the meantime, you had a lot of individual investors who wanted certificates in their names. So the broker-dealers would submit transfer instructions to us, and we would basically reach into the vault, take a CD certificate, send it to the transfer agent with a transfer instruction, let's say in your name. The transfer agent would now take the certificate out of CEDE&Co name, put it in your name, return it to DTC. DTC now would return it to Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch would mail it to you.
Okay.
So that was a very, very expensive, very cumbersome process.
And that was always through the broker-dealers? You never had some little old lady show up at the door?
Oh, no. We were strictly dealt with broker-dealers and banks.
Right, okay. At the same time during this period, DTC also began holding new types of instruments. The first one was bearer bonds.
Well, the first, initially, to give the proper sequence, is we went from New York Stock Exchange-only issues to over-the-counter, as they were called in those days, issues, later to be known as NASDAQ issues. Then we made corporate bonds eligible, which was, again, a very challenging process, because once again, a lot of the banks did not keep their corporate bonds at DTC, and the brokers were up in arms over the fact that we made this new type of security eligible, and they went back to the old problem of having to withdraw the security from DTC and physically deliver it to the banks. But gradually, again, history repeated itself, and the banks gradually began to keep all of their corporate bonds in DTC.
So then
we went to municipals.
Then you had the municipals. Okay. And as you expanded the types of instruments that you would hold, who was really pushing that? Was it DTC looking for new business, or was it the participants saying that we need somebody to do
this? It was really a combination of both. Yeah. The board of DTC was comprised of banks and broker-dealers. The board met monthly. We had various committees that would give us guidance as to what was the next important thing that we should work on. So I'd have to say it was a combination of our own self-interest in wanting to do more business where we felt we were capable of doing it, coupled with our participants asking us to make these types of securities eligible.
Mm-hmm. What was the most challenging of these new types of instruments?
I'd have to say two of them. Commercial paper, because it was strictly a book entry only type of instrument, and for the first time we were settling those through Fed funds.
Was that in 1990? Was that that's the date I have here?
What I would recommend to you, James, is what I do is when I'm asked those kinds of questions, get a complete set of DTCC annual reports. And if you can read them from cover to cover, you'll have an absolutely accurate history of when things happened. But my recollection is you're right. It was in the early 90s.
Okay.
And then bearer bonds were a real challenge, because you had the massive numbers of bonds were deposited into DTC, and each of them had these coupons that had to be clipped or cut twice a year. Those coupons were fully negotiable. If you lost them, you lost them. And so the millions and millions of coupons that we had to cut each year and make sure we didn't lose them, make sure we got paid correctly from the trustee for the bond issue, that was an enormous operational challenge.
So you had staff members that did nothing but cut coupons?
We had a famous situation. We had a big vault out in Garden City, Long Island, that was built specifically to our specifications, probably one of the biggest securities vaults in the world. And we had armies of people that did part-time work, and we all got a chuckle out of the fact that one of our coupon cutters showed up every day in a beautiful Cadillac, went into work cutting coupons, and it turned out that she was the wife of a prominent doctor who just essentially wanted to get out of the house and do something, and she got to know the other ladies or gentlemen who were cutting coupons in this particular area, so they had a sort of social network while they were busy tearing off these little pieces of paper and preparing them for a payment.
Wow, yeah. You mentioned the vault on Long Island. I understand that DTCC later got rid of the vault.
Well, essentially what happened is that as you know, Congress outlawed bearer certificates. All subsequent municipal issues came out either in registered form or no certificates at all, book entry only. So gradually, as bearer issues matured, there was less and less need for the vast amount of physical space we had on Long Island, because we actually built a second vault on top of the first one when the municipal program first grew at such enormous growth patterns. But then over time, book entry only, and the diminution of the number of bearer bonds that were in existence. It became clear that we could go back to the original vault in New York that we first started with, that it was large enough to hold the assets that, even though the amount, dollar value of the assets we had were hundreds of fold larger than when we first began, they were now either in the FAST program, which I described earlier, book entry only, or they were at the Fed, commercial paper. And
do you know what happened to the vaults, though? I was just curious.
Honestly, I don't know. I would think the landlord would have had a heck of a time trying to market them for something else. At one point, there was some serious consideration by someone on the street to take them from us and make them a depository for people's gold and other valuables, because they were, believe me, quite impregnable, quite impressive. But that never really took hold either, so I really don't know what became of them.
So one of the things that DTC did was that it helped to handle proxy communications for shareholders. That was done by something called the nominee system. What was the nominee system?
Well, the basic concept, it was actually called the omnibus proxy system. The basic concept is that on the record date for an annual meeting, DTC would send to the issuer, here's a list of all of our participants, and here's the holdings that our participants had in your security on the record date. And then we gave up our right to vote the shares, even though they were in CD and co name, and gave the right to vote to the individual participants listed on this particular listing that went to the issuer. The issuer, in turn, would contact the various broker dealers and banks that were on our listing and basically determine that they were voting, and if they weren't voting, how many sets of proxy material they need to send, primarily to the broker dealers, who in turn would send them to the actual beneficial holder. And this was somewhat of a controversial issue for DTC for a number of years, because issuers felt that one of the detriments of a depository system was that they became more and more distanced from the actual beneficial owner. And there was quite a bit of discussion as to how to remedy that situation. And the industry came up with what was called the NOBO-OBO system. NOBOs were non-objecting beneficial owners, and OBOs were objecting beneficial owners. And so if you were a customer of Merrill Lynch, Merrill Lynch would ask you, James, do you mind if we identify to the issuer your name and address as a beneficial holder of its securities? If you said, no, I don't mind, then you were a NOBO. And they would be willing to transmit to the issuer, of our 100,000 customers who own IBM, dear IBM, 75,000 of them are NOBOs who are willing to let you know who they are directly, and here are the names. But if you said, no, I don't want IBM to know my name specifically as an owner of the security, then you were an OBO, and Merrill Lynch would not transmit your information directly to the issuer. Now, Merrill Lynch would send you proxy material, because they would tell the issuer, okay, in total, we own 2 million shares of IBM, and we have 100, I'm making this up, obviously, we have 100,000 customers, send me 100,000 sets of proxy material, and I will mail them out to the customer. Bottom line, the biggest issue in this whole area were takeover concerns. The issuers felt that if somebody was trying to make a move and acquire their shares for takeover purposes or whatever purpose, the old system where certificates were registered in the individual owners' names gave you some kind of an indication as to who owned your securities, although, not to spend a lot of time on this, that was a little bit of a red herring also, because banks would traditionally hold all of their securities in bank nominee name. So Goldman Sachs could be accumulating a tremendous amount of a given target security, but through Bank of New York, as I say. Bank of New York is still showing a large holding in its nominee, whatever it is, let's say it's Boney and Co. So you, the issuer, still didn't have direct access to the information as to who specifically was trying to accumulate your securities.
So the problem would have been there, whether or not there was depository.
Right. In my judgment, the problem was there regardless of the fact that there was a depository. But it was raised constantly by the issuers that the depository was interfering with its contact with its beneficial shareholders. And the omnibus proxy system and this NOBO-OBO system were basically constructed to try to mitigate those concerns.
Did you keep records about what percentage of beneficial owners were NOBOs and what percentage were OBOs?
No, we didn't know that because that was the broker who knew that information. We had no, our only customer was Merrill Lynch. We never looked through Merrill Lynch to any customer beyond that. But Merrill Lynch knew which of its customers were NOBOs and OBOs.
Okay.
We never knew that.
While they were creating the system of NOBO and OBO, did the DTC participate at all? Did you offer an opinion, or did you just stand back and say, we'll let you all discuss this and we'll adapt to whatever decision?
My recollection is that we encouraged people to come up with a solution because of the criticism that was being levied at us, in my judgment, unfairly. But my recollection, James, is that we did not spend a tremendous amount of our own effort. We felt this was an industry issue that was best resolved between the issuers and the ultimate owners of the securities, the broker-dealers and the banks.
Okay. So were you working at DTC during the savings and loan crisis?
Yes.
Okay. Now, how did that affect the operations there?
Frankly, minimally, because it was largely a crisis of confidence, as these savings and loans, as you know, went out and bought all sorts of real estate and basically failed as the value of those real estate deals, went under. But it didn't affect us directly.
The stock crash in 1987 did pose a few challenges for DTC, right?
Only in volumes. Mm-hmm. It was an unprecedented surge in trading volumes, which frankly, we were very proud of the fact that our computer systems held up very well, and we processed everything perfectly fine without any kind of interruptions or problems whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. So there were no major problems, but at the same time, some people were a little bit concerned after the stock market crash about the settlement cycle and its length. There was a report put out by the SEC's Division of Market Regulation soon after the stock market crash that said that the length of the trade settlement cycle created a major crunch for the securities processing industry.
Well, I don't think I think the problem was risk. The argument was, and I think it's a valid argument, the shorter the period is between a trade occurring and you finally settling the trade, the less risk you have of something going awry. And so there was a G30, I think, was the group that really pushed the argument that we should start to tighten the number of days between settlement. And the initial thrust, which is still with us today, was T+3 as opposed to T+5. And I think generally speaking, there were some exceptions, but generally speaking, the industry concurred that that was a very doable, it was an objective that could be met, and that it made sense to do so. So we spent a great deal of time working to implement T-plus resettlement at DTC.
Right. Uh-huh. In 1994, you became a CIO.
Yes.
And I guess the three-day settlement cycle, the T-plus 3, must have been the major object on your plate.
Yes.
At that point in time. What sort of changes had to be implemented in order to achieve T-plus 3?
Well, we basically had to look at all of our systems and confirm, almost like the year 2000, you had to look at your systems and make sure that you didn't have any code that specifically was earmarked to a five-day settlement cycle, and then if you did, make certain that it was modified to be able to switch to a three-day settlement cycle. Frankly, because of CNS and the way CNS worked, it was relatively, I thought, straightforward to do. I don't think it was as challenging as the year 2000 work was because, you know, we knew our systems, we went through them carefully, and we just simply modified them to work on a tighter time frame. NSCC, I think, in fairness, had even more work than DTC did because NSCC was the actual organization that took in the trade input, produced those compared trade summaries we discussed much earlier, had the CNS system, was under its purview. So they had to do quite a bit more processing changes, in my judgment, than DTC had to do.
Did NSCC and DTC or DTC have to work with the participants to train them on the side?
Oh, no. We ran several tests that we basically ran on Saturdays. We got everybody in the street to show up on Saturday. We created a fictitious trade date, if you will, and we ran simulations of clearing all the transactions. We, as I recall, we took a particular day in the past, pretended now that it was a T-plus 3 settlement instead of T-plus 5, and then everybody ran through this day-long weekend test. I honestly don't recall. I think we did it. We did it at least twice. We might have done it three times before we went live with T-plus 3, which was completely uneventful, by the way. Smooth, one of the smoothest transitions of major changes in the industry I've ever been involved in.
And then immediately after T-plus 3, you began working on same-day fund settlements for equity transactions?
Because, again, up to this point, settlement had been on a clearinghouse next-day basis. And we would, at the end of the day, we would accept in payment certified checks drawn on New York clearinghouse banks, and we in return would credit participants with next day money also. And as part of the whole effort again of reducing risk, the thinking was this is foolish to be settling all these transactions in next day money. Let's go to federal funds where settlement is irrevocable. Once it occurs, it occurs. Money has changed hands. There's no possibility that a bank may fail overnight, that this check is drawn against that particular bank, you know, that kind of thing. The Drexel Burnham situation, I think, when they went out of business.
Tell me a little about that.
Well, essentially, you had a very confused situation where Drexel, which had been, as you know, a powerhouse firm, Milken was their most visible, I guess, public face, basically overextended themselves and collapsed. And mortgage-backed securities in particular was one of the areas that they were heavily involved in. And the Fed got involved, and they had this big meeting at the Fed where people were marking fails and actually trying to straighten out deliveries of mortgage-backed securities that had involved Drexel Burnham. And I think that was the crisis that I think focused people's attention on the fact dramatically that irrevocable settlement in same-day funds made a heck of a lot of sense as opposed to running the risk of settling in next day funds and having something happen overnight that maybe rendered the settlement incomplete.
Was that change more or less complicated than T+3?
In my judgment, again, because we already did same day funds with certain types of securities like commercial paper, we essentially extended the concepts that we had already thought through with commercial paper. But we did make an enormous number of rule changes that, and we put in enormous numbers of controls to make certain that we were fully protected in the event that, a broker-dealer or a bank failed. Under the same-day fund settlement system, DTC is the owner of all securities that are delivered to the receiver until the receiver pays for them. So we put in very elaborate, very strong controls that if, for example, a major broker-dealer, let's say Lehman Brothers, which didn't happen, of course, until much later, but Lehman Brothers failed, and Lehman owed DTC, let's say, $600 million for deliveries of trades that they got that day. The way the system was designed, Lehman is now bankrupt, we know that. So now we say, well, all of those securities that were delivered to Lehman, DTC owns. And DTC now has the right, since Lehman didn't pay for the securities, to go into the market and sell those securities. But we also had what's called a clearing fund. Every broker and every bank contributed to a fund. It was mostly broker-dealers, I shouldn't say the banks, that basically Lehman would have contributed, let's say, $100 million to this particular clearing fund. And we would have been marking these securities to market every day so that we would increase or decrease that $100 million that Lehman had in clearing the fund, depending on which side of the market they were on. But if Lehman failed, we would now sell all of those securities. And if we suffered a loss because the market had gone down and we weren't able to get the full amount of that we owed the counterparty, we would take money out of Lehman's clearing fund to make us whole. And it was a very elaborate system, very carefully thought through. Fortunately, it never ever broke. And in fact, when Lehman did fail some years later, it worked perfectly. Mm-hmm. You know, DTC, as you know, never suffered a dollar's worth of loss because of any of the failures of any of the participants that occurred, you know, since we put the system in.
Mm-hmm. Also during the 1990s, there was the development of what was called the equity repo market, and DTC played a role in that.
Well, although equity repos was a factor and was developed, it never, to my recollection, ever became a big business. Most repos, as you know, are done with government securities. And somebody had the idea that, well, if you do them for governments, why can't you do them for equities? Mm-hmm. But the problem, of course, is governments, at least until recent situations, had always been absolute gilt-edged securities that you knew were always going to be there and always going to be valued pretty much close to face. The problem with equity repos is obviously the repo that you did, the equity could have been Enron, and you thought you were fully protected because you had the collateral. So there was a move afoot to do equity repos. Frankly, from my experience, it never actually really took off. I don't know what you're basing your question on, but
it becomes a bit like a short, right?
Well, no, the idea is you want to borrow money. And I have a whole bunch of Enron in my possession. Mm-hmm. I want to keep the Enron, but I have need to finance something else. So I basically go to you and say, lend me, you know, $100 million. I'm going to give you $150 million worth of Enron as collateral. And then 10 days from now, we're going to reverse the transaction. I'll pay you back what you lent me. Mm-hmm. You return the Enron to me.
Right.
But the risk that you're running mm-hmm. is that you've already given me my money uh-huh. and it's collateralized by something that all of a sudden could turn out to be worth much less
right.
than you expected. So for that reason, my recollection is that equity repos never really,
never got
frankly, took off, unless you have information to the contrary.
No, this is just a it was a phenomenon that a lot of people talked about at the time as a developing market.
It definitely was discussed. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of fanfare, but my clear recollection is it never really amounted to much because of that inherent risk.
Okay,
it's not like you and I are exchanging government securities for cash. You're exchanging
right,
something
more
that's yeah. much more dangerous.
So. Right. So now I'm going to talk with you a little bit about the preparations for the merger with NSCC. When did it become obvious that there was going to be a merger between the two organizations?
Well, I think that when Bill Dentzer retired and Bill Janicki became the chairman of DTC, Dave Kelly was the chairman of NSCC, and I think the broker-dealers in particular, in fact, predominantly the broker-dealers felt that there could be further economies of scale realized by combining these two organizations as opposed to the industry financing both of them. So that really, in the, I'd say the mid-90s on, became a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was a personality issue. The industry liked Dave Kelly and the industry liked Bill Janicki. And the feeling was one of those two people would have to be the basic runner or chief executive, if you will, of the combined company. And there was a lot of discussion as to how that would work. And, gee, there'd be a lot of political clashes possibly between the two organizations, things of that nature. But then, basically, Bill decided to retire. Jill Considine was chosen by the board to replace Bill Janicki. Jill came in with none of that political baggage whatsoever, and I think it was very apparent early on to the main broker-dealer executives who were pushing this concept that she was a very, very capable and very exceptionally gifted manager. And with Bill Janicki, frankly, gone from the scene, and DTCC being so much of a larger organization than NSCC was, it was done, I think, with some grace and some care, particularly given Dave mm-hmm. Kelly's personal feelings about the matter, but the decision was made to merge mm-hmm. the two companies, and Jill was chosen to be the person that was going to run the merged mm-hmm. company.
Clearly, the two organizations had a lot of redundant functions. I mean, that was one of the reason for merging them in the first place. But did that culture clash at the top replicate itself on down the line? Or?
Well, I think, frankly, no, because just it was a matter of scale. You know, you had 3,000 or whatever the number is DTC employees, and you had 300 NSCC employees, and I'm obviously not giving you accurate mm-hmm. figures. And I think the NSCC employees were, intelligent enough to realize that this was going to happen. Jill Considine was going to be the person running the combined organization. And frankly, I think people did what you should do in a situation like that. They realized that it was in their best interest to be cooperative and embracing of this change as opposed to being antagonistic and possibly running the risk they tossed out the door because they weren't contributing in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that made a difference too is that at the time there was a computer operation called SIAC, the Securities Industry Automation Corporation. And SIAC was doing all of the systems work for NSCC at a fairly hefty price tag.
Was SIAC a private company?
No, SIAC was basically owned by the American Stock Exchange and the New York Stock Exchange, and the NASD. With, I think, as memory serves me correctly, the New York Stock Exchange having the biggest piece of the pie. And so one of the savings that was frankly pretty evident of this combination of NSCC and DTC is DTC had the computer wherewithal to basically run the systems that SIAC was running for NSCC. And so a big part of the savings had to do with just simply putting all of that computer work on computers that DTC already had. But it was a little controversial because SIAC was a profit-making organization for the New York Stock Exchange, and there was some discussion there over time as to how that, but ultimately that transition occurred. The savings were realized, and it was very successful.
So you talked about the goal of reducing costs as one motivating factor for the merger. Were there also hopes that a merged organization could implement a faster settlement cycle?
No, I think the other leading reason was risk reduction. That as good as NSCC was and as good as DTC was, you basically had two different risk systems. Basically, in some regards, relying on the same securities as the underlying collateral in case there was a problem. So I think in addition to the cost savings, there was an understanding that you'd have some risk reduction if you had a single risk, integrated risk system, as opposed to a risk system run by two separate organizations.
But no one was hoping to get to T plus one at this time?
Well, there was an organization that was an industry funded organization called the Straight-Through Processing, Global Straight-Through Processing, GSTPA, I think was the name of it. Global Security Straight-Through Processing, something like that. And they began pushing the concept of going to T plus one. It had some momentum for a while, but then the individual broker-dealers and the banks were funding this particular organization. And my recollection, or my clear recollection, is that after a number of years of fairly substantial funding, the organization was no closer to actually having a workable T plus one concept than it was when it first started. And there was a dip in the market around this time. And GSTPA needed some additional funding, and they went back to the individual banks and broker-dealers that had supported them up to this particular point in time, and they ran into a roadblock. That with no actual concrete system development to show for all the money that had been spent up to this particular time, and a dip in the securities markets, which made funding, additional funding, you know, going to be an unlikely, that organization frankly just sort of fell apart. Yeah. And to the best of my knowledge, and I've been retired now, as I said, almost 9 years, there's never been a resurgence, or a significant resurgence in interest in going to T plus one.
How did people at DTCC feel about this idea of T plus one? I mean, was it just kind of a pie in the sky idea, or did they think it was something that they should be working towards?
I think the general feeling was, look, we already successfully went from T plus five to T plus three, so the concept of shortening the settlement cycle had been successfully engineered the first time around. I think, though, there was, at least from my vantage point, speaking just for myself, a great deal of indifference, that it was vastly more complicated to shorten the cycle again, because you have this tremendous number of trades, and you do need some time to straighten out errors or problems where the trades didn't exactly, mm-hmm. you know, hit completely. I think DTC, to its credit, had built some terrific risk mitigation systems that were widely recognized as being, you know, pretty successful. NSCC, the arm of DTCC, took responsibility for a trade once it was matched. So if a trade matched on trade day plus one, NSCC was on the hook for that trade. So how much more were you actually gaining by trying to compress everything into a, mm-hmm. you know, a tighter settlement cycle? And I think, honestly, most people, particularly wearied of the tremendous amount of money that was wasted, in my judgment, by the GSTPA organization, I think the whole issue just died. And to the best of my knowledge, has not resurfaced again.
So after the merger, you became the chief operating officer for DTCC?
Right.
Yeah. And what was your work primarily concentrated on?
Well, essentially what happened is that there were some other clearing corporations that were out there that everyone felt should be brought into the DTCC umbrella. One of them was the Mortgage-Backed Securities Clearing Corporation, which had originally been developed in Chicago, and a depository called Participants Trust Company, which essentially was a depository for mortgage-backed securities, Ginnie Mae's, etc. And so, and there was another arm of NSCC called a Government Securities Clearing Corporation, which, as the name implies, cleared government securities. And so basically, Jill Considine, the chairman of DTCC, gave me the assignment of bringing these organizations into the fold. And I became the CEO of MBSCC and the CEO of GSCC. Ultimately, they all became merged with into the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, so that it was a separate, rather than keep them individually shoehorned, we put them into the Fixed Income Clearing Corporation, mm-hmm. and basically had all fixed income securities cleared through that clearing corporation.
And the major incentive behind putting all these together was cutting costs?
Cutting costs, and again, going back to risk, trying to reduce risk by having everything looked at mm-hmm. as one single entity, as opposed to each of these organizations having their own individual risk systems.
What, was the SEC or other regulators interested in that? I mean, were they scrutinizing it, or did they have to approve it?
Well, anything that DTC did, or DTCC did, basically you needed the concurrence of the SEC and the Fed. I don't frankly remember this being a source of controversy at all, and I don't recall there being a tremendous amount of scrutiny. I think our track record up to that point had been pretty good in terms of mm-hmm. merging other organizations into DTCC. So although they did have to give their approval, my clear recollection is that it was not a long drawn out nor controversial mm-hmm. you know, process.
So after 3 years at DTCC in 2003, you decided to retire?
Well, essentially, I underwent a triple bypass operation in 2001. Age 55 was the earliest age that I could economically successfully retire from DTC. I went in to see Jill about 6 months before my retirement, basically told her that the triple bypass had been a real wake-up call to me, and that some of the doctors who treated me felt that the stress of working for a large organization like DTC, an important organization like DTCC, plus the commute, which in my case was a 4 hour a day commute, which I had already done for 35 years or so, I told Jill that, you know, my wife and I had talked it over, and even though financially I would have been better off staying for obvious reasons, I felt I had accomplished what I wanted to accomplish in my career, that I did not want to run the risk of further health issues. She was very gracious about it, understood, you know, that that was that triple bypass operation is a wake-up call for anybody.
And, understandable.
We had a very, very, very capable guy named Don Donahue who was waiting in the wings to take over much more responsibility than he already had. And so it worked out perfectly well. I retired in May of 2003, and Don, as you know, became president and ultimately the chairman and CEO of GTCC upon Jill's retirement.
Before we started this interview, you mentioned a phrase to me, plumbers of the industry, which had once been applied to DTC. Where did that
come
from?
Well, it wasn't applied specifically to DTC, but mm-hmm. Jerry Corrigan had been invited to speak at an industry meeting. I believe it was at the time, it was called the Securities Industry Association. They invited Jerry to speak. Jerry was at the New York Fed at the time. And to his credit, Jerry was, you know, well aware of the importance that clearance and settlement played in the securities markets. And his talk was to that point, although I have to admit, he referred to people that did the kind of work that I did as the plumbers of the industry, which I'm assuming he meant to be complimentary, but maybe it struck me a little bit odd at the time, but I never quite viewed that as being a very complimentary adjective or descriptor, rather, for the kind of work that we did. As I said, I'm sure it was very well intentioned. It just seemed to me like an odd phrase to describe one's career as the plumber of the securities industry.
Well, Mr. Dirks, looking back over your career, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Well, I think that the only thing I'd say is that I think DTC is the perfect example of not wasting a good crisis. That if it weren't for the paperwork crisis of the late 60s, where Wall Street basically almost came to a halt, I doubt if a very successful organization like DTC would have ever been started. But because everyone realized that something had to be done and had to be done quickly, I think that helped modernize the entire United States securities market, even though at the time it was viewed as we have to do this because if we don't, we're going to be out of business. So there's the old cliche that you hate to waste a good crisis, and I think in this particular case, it was not wasted. And a very solid, very reputable organization was created out of necessity. But it proved to be, I think, over the years, a real boon to the securities industry. And I'm glad and proud to, you know, play the part.
That sounds like a good lesson for all of us. Dennis Dirks, thank you very much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.